Welcome to the Gestalten Podcast, and this time presented to you by Pathfinder, powered by Concept House, your number one source for internships and entry-level positions into the car design and transportation design industry. Go online and find Pathfinder on www.pathfinder.careers and sign up for this free service. Now, my name is Martin Groschwald, and in this week's episode, I am very happy to welcome Paul Snyder of the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. And with Paul, we have discussed a little bit the role of the future designer, where this will develop towards, what this will mean for the current students studying design and transportation design in particular, and also what this will mean for the entire industry. So enjoy the conversation with Paul Snyder, and don't forget, obviously, to give us 5 stars on iTunes if you listen to on that. Like us on, you know, all the other platforms that you might be listening to us. And without further ado, let's crack on. Here's Paul, and here's myself, and here's the episode. Let's go.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you. And obviously, we're recording here in the afternoon in German time, and it's the morning in Detroit. Welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Martin. It's really nice to be here, or to be chatting with you.
Now, when we had a little bit of a pre-chat, and, like, you know, we were discussing what kind of topic we wanted to discuss about, I had this a little bit of a, let's say, aggressive kind of proposal. And I said, like, you know, why don't we talk about the fact that, you know, you work in education, and do we think that car designers in the future actually design cars? And you said, hey, that sounds really interesting. So here we are with that. But my first question to you is actually more related to a little bit of your background, because you have experience, quite a lot of experience, actually, as a teacher, as a professor at the Pratt Institute, at CCS, now in Detroit, of course, as well. But also, you have been extremely hands-on in your past as well. So you're not just this typical professor who's never worked in the industry before. Over the past, let's say, 5 to 10 years, when you moved from the industry back into education, was obviously also the time where UX came into play very much. Interior design was more and more important. What was the observation that you had that, you know, affected you the most in your education, or how did it change your perception of education with these changes coming in, that, let's say, an exterior is not the most important one anymore, but there's other ones that, you know, other areas that are now coming into this educational area?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, it makes me think in terms of one of the most impactful experiences, it probably was going to graduate school in New York. When I was teaching car design at Pratt Institute, I was also for at least 1 year at the same time finishing up graduate school in New York City in fine art. When you study fine art, like an MFA, at many schools, you get into a lot of critical theory, literary theory, the politics of art making are core and extremely fundamental to the creation of culture. So, excuse me. So all these notions of divining meaning out of what we do, whether you're writing a story or a text or designing a car, are pushed to the forefront, and deciding exactly who your audience is and what you're trying to say becomes a critical factor in art making. And that was something in my BFA in transportation design that we never really covered. It was all about, you know, the craft primarily. I mean, you know, in a 4-year degree, you're going to cover some psychology, you're going to cover some philosophy. But it's all very sort of introductory, unless you're, you know, going into a liberal arts degree. But a Bachelor of Fine Arts or a Bachelor of Science is really about the profession that you want to be in. And as we all know, you really don't need a graduate degree in order to be a car designer, right? You need a smoking hot portfolio and a passion for it. And usually 4 years is enough to get you there. So putting all this together, what I uncovered or discovered, as it were, was, for example, the notions of deconstruction. Like, what was that all about? And how was that, where did that originate from? And it wasn't an architectural movement at first. It was really a way of understanding a text. And that kind of blew my mind, because when you start to deconstruct what we do as designers, whether it be a car designer or a product designer, you start to think about the meaning behind your craft or your work. And so when I come back to teaching now, I think in the context of the 21st century and this kind of liberal democracy that seems to be struggling right now, but basically it's the best answer we have as a species to move forward. Liberal democracy with capitalism is the order of the day. So if we start to talk about, you know, emotional design and car design, and we start to talk about how so much design is superfluous and you know, just sort of void of meaning, then we're talking about styling. But when we start to talk about making the world a better place, and then we start to talk about design, in terms of transportation design, you know, the distinction between automotive design and product design, they used to be part of the same department, right? Industrial design. But, you know, as so many professions have become more and more specialized, where you really drill down into one particular aspect of a field, they sort of grew apart. And there's certainly still an arrogance amongst transportation designers or car designers that, and I'm, you know, I'm guilty of that as well. I think that car designers can design anything. But what I try to do now is instill in my students that, you know, starting with the human user and making the world a better place is really what's going to give you meaning in your life as a car designer. And you know, that might sound very profound and very, you know, highfalutin, but I think it's a pretty core lesson to be learned from humanism in general, that we're not just here to, you know, create landfill of the future, but at the same time, human beings will always have a propensity to choose between their favorite whatever and somebody else's, right? Whether that be the red pickup or the black pickup, it may be, you know, the choice to drive an economy car or a luxury car. So choice is what's always going to keep us employed, and taste. And whether or not we're designing cars, I think is really, it's a question of, you know, how do you define a car? Is a car something that has to have a steering wheel? You know, and when that goes away, are we still car designers? Or are we, you know, designers of spaces that move? So what my approach to transportation design at CCS is it's anything that moves. So it may be a robot, it may be a jet ski, it may be a truck, and it may be a sports car. And I think in approaching it that way, you're going back to the fundamentals of the design process, which is, you know, you start out with a discovery mission. It's like, what's out there? And you try and identify new human needs or problems that can be solved. And so that's problem definition after you've discovered a lot of things and opportunities. And then you develop and deliver it. So in the definition of your problem lies usually a human need or a pain point that can be solved for. And if it's you know, if that human need is a toaster, then it's a product design. If a human need is something that moves, then it's transportation design. So car design, you know, guys like my friend Chris Bangle, who was at CCS a couple of years ago, he's trying to elevate car design to some other category of culture making, and that's cool. You know, we can talk about how designers are more skilled in one thing than the other, because we do drill down into aesthetics so thoroughly. The understanding of proportions and beauty, probably more than most product design departments and institutions. So, you know, but that doesn't negate the fact that we're still designing things that need to work. So it really goes back to the form and the function and which one leads. But the distinction between, you know, what we call ourselves now and historically and what we're calling ourselves in the future, I think is kind of a moot point, because what we need to be doing is just making the world a better place, you know, and enjoying ourselves along the way. And it comes down to, you know, first it's got to work, and then, you know, what color do you want?
How I find it always very difficult, because if you look into the media nowadays, you see these extremely fancy and very crafty sketches.
Yeah.
But it takes away so much of what the actual design process actually is. It shows oftentimes that the designer in the representation is almost like a painter. Yeah, you know, somebody who comes up with an idea and then other people will do it for them. How do you communicate that design is so much more than just a sketch, that the sketch is part of this entire process, to not only your students? Yeah, because obviously a lot of them, quite naive in the beginning, come in like, yeah, we want to do some cool sketches and all these things.
Yeah.
But also educate your, you know, the partners that you have, the companies that you do projects with, just to look at these students differently, and not just to say, don't always just look for the best sketcher, look for what is the best designer. Because it seems sometimes to me that, you know, they're competing for the next cool stuff rather than, you know, actually understanding what is the best designer out of this. And how do you deal with that? I mean, do you lead your students, of course, but or do you also lead the partners that you do projects with, or do you just sometimes have to, you know, give in and just like, look, if you just want to have the best schedule, then that's the way it is?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the fact is, I don't think anything has changed in the industry. When you think about the students or the new graduates that get the interview or that get the internship, their portfolio is always full of the really super hot sketches, right? Mm-hmm. So while a lot of hiring managers and design leaders will talk about how, you know, the customer is always right, and putting the customer first and user-centered design and all these other, you know, very virtuous kinds of ways of approaching what we do, the hot scotch always is the one that, you know, gets the job or gets the interview. And students know that. So what I try to do is, and this is kind of the vision and the mission of my department, and that's, you know, each one of these young people have to be thoroughly steeped and versed in the mastery of traditional skill sets. And that's in the first 2 years. And after that, the junior year and the senior year, okay, what are you going to do with it? And, you know, it because everything is just so regurgitated or incestuous now with Instagram and Pinterest. Everything is, it's so rare to see something really fresh. Hot sketches are all over the place, but if it's really fresh, then it's like, wow. And that might be just a sculptural idea, or it may be a functional idea. But when you see it, that's what's outstanding, because the hot sketch has become, you know, kind of, I don't know, it's you, what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of democratized in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of really good schools. CCS is only one of them. I think we're the best, but, you know, you go to Florsheim, you go to Art Center, and there's a lot of hot sketchers coming out of all these different places around the world, even Kafa now in China.
Yeah.
So what distinguishes the hot sketch or one student's hot sketch from another is the content and the meaning that's imbued in the work. And so through our design theory classes, we talk about these issues of the starting point for any given project.
Hmm.
And, you know, if it's purely aesthetic, that could be okay. It's still, you know, it has to be built, and it, you know, it's, you want a quality execution of that. But there's always going to be another opposing factor. And this goes back to the early days of the Bauhaus, the form and the function. So the hot sketch is the price of entry.
So how do you think, obviously moving forward, you've already mentioned the space on wheels, the movable space in that sense. And that's obviously with automation and the digitalization, you know, autonomy, everything that comes into that, that's going to be somehow limited in terms of what you can do from an exterior perspective, because at some point you will get to a point where all these, you know, vehicles need to talk to each other. They need to have a certain purpose. So we're all almost going back to pragmatism in that system as well. So at that point, the sketch will not just bring you onto the job anymore, you know, if we take that idea a little bit further. So what do you think if we take back this idea of, like, you know, that the car designer of the future doesn't necessarily design a car anymore? What do you think from your own experience, you know, over the past 2 decades or so, but also with the students that you have taught, is something to move forward that is absolutely, you know, it's just like a must have that you need to have as a designer, apart from the sketching that just needs to be there to succeed?
Right. Well, you know, I think going back to the notion of choice and personal taste, the real question is, if you're going to own it, or if you're just using it.
Mm-hmm.
So the role of the designer in that equation is, you know, extremely critical, because even if let's say mobility is completely democratized and, you know, you can have a robot come and pick you up at your front door, or you can still own a car if you want to own a car that could platoon in with fleets of other vehicles that are platooning down the highway. The distinction between whether it's shared or owned is going to be critical as the starting point. The function has to be different. The materials have to be different. But there will still be choice, and there will still be ways of expressing taste. Like right now, you know, even if you're extremely wealthy, you may choose to stay at a Holiday Inn versus the, you know, the Hyatt or, you know, one of the higher end hotels. So I don't see transportation being any different. Car designers that can understand that distinction and still offer real value and experiences in a safe, shared scenario will still, I think, distinguish themselves from those who are strictly only trying to make something functional and shape and safe. For example, you look at the Ollie, right? Mm-hmm. This is just pure, you know, expression of a volume that will accommodate 6 to 8 people, and the way it's manufactured. There's very little regard for the way that thing looks, right? It was very, very secondary to its function. It doesn't have to look like that. It's just a very early iteration. And while the volume might not change and the seating positions might not change for a shared mobility experience, certainly the appearance of it and the care with which designers address specific human pain points and needs will definitely be opportunities for somebody to express their role in the world. You know, do I want to travel with Virgin Atlantic, or do I want to travel on JetBlue? You know, it's the choices are always going to be there. And, you know, and this gets into one of the other things that you've been writing about on LinkedIn and so on. And that's the, you know, with all these technologies in manufacturing that are coming on and the sort of cycles of contraction, expansion in the industry, a lot of the young designers in school now may be working in a more gig economy like a social structure where, you know, perhaps they're working for one company who has access to a you know, an electric platform to do their body work. And the next year they're working for some other company with completely different parameters because the service is going to be where the money is, not the manufacturer. Selling miles, not selling cars.
Exactly. And do you think in regards to the education that you're going towards, what you've obviously described is not necessarily just, you know, exterior and interior and color and trim and UI, UX, and everything is going to be done by someone differently, because we're talking about an overall experience and you have the haptical point of the experience. So the understanding of, you know, every designer working on these products needs to be much more than maybe just a little island that they prefer to be on, such as exterior only. I'm not saying everybody's going to be like that. I'm pretty sure there's going to be absolute specialists and, like, you know, these masterminds that will only be working on exteriors. But how do you react to that, that this multidiscipline, you know, knowledge and, you know, opportunity comes in now, and explain that to the students and also explain it to, you know, the people working on these projects, like Ford, like FCA, like GM, of course, in Detroit, is to say, like, maybe you don't need an exterior guy anymore. You just need an understandable designer who knows, you know, what's going on around him, because with these new technologies, you have to be able to adapt. You have to have a certain background, maybe, you know, to a certain degree in engineering as well, to understand what's required from me, because otherwise we're just going back to styling and somebody is putting it into production.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, one thing that we definitely are doing is we're doing a lot of collaboration. When a company or a philanthropist comes to CCS with a project, that's a collaboration between the faculty and the company, and it's also a collaboration between the students and the company and the faculty. So we try to set it up as close to a professional design scenario as possible. For example, when FCA came to us about 1 year ago, they return every year and a half on a rotation. So we're really fortunate to have their support. But this last year, what we did is we collaborated between
the collaboration with the FCA and the others.
Right. So we pulled three departments together for that collaboration, which was really, really cool. So we did an exterior class, we did a architectural interior class, and we did a fashion accessories class. And all three of those classes, students from each of those classes were teamed up into teams of three to design a brand experience. So we didn't do the interior that semester, but I'll get to another project where we did. That semester, the brand experience was about, okay, you have this beautiful exterior design, and then you have a brand experience showroom, much like what Tesla's been doing in malls and things like that, circumventing the dealership model. And then you also have brand line extensions in terms of accessories and things like that. So, you know, as you can buy Ferrari branded shoes and Porsche branded sunglasses, what if Dodge or Ram had, and Jeep and Fiat and Alfa and Maserati, what if each one of those had a different brand experience? And Ralph was really thrilled with that project, and it really set off a kind of a new way of collaborating within the school. So we had three different classes, three different instructors, all collaborating, students from each class on a team collaborating, and it really came off really well. And then the following year, this was just this last fall, we did a Cadillac project where we had color materials teaming up with interior design students. And that was just stunning. The students took it to a new level. And then this last semester, we had interior design students collaborating with exterior design students, addressing the future potential brand width of the Ford Mach-E. I guess they're considering taking the Mach-E Mustang into its own brand, and having multiple sort of lifestyle vehicles, I suppose, all branded under the Mustang badge. So that was a really interesting project. When it comes to drilling down and specializing in one thing or another, that's always been something that I've pushed back against. When I was at Ford, I was first hired at Ford back in the 80s, there was really no distinction. They moved us around. I did interiors, I did exteriors, and always working closely with the engineers and the color materials specialists. But when I was at Honda, it was, you were either interior or exterior, and you'd never cross that line. And I thought that was kind of unfortunate. At Honda, we were very, very specialized. And I asked if I could do an interior project next, after I had done multiple exteriors, and they were like, no, we really want you to just do the exterior of this next project. So I did an interior on my own time, just to sort of complete the vision. And I've been talking a lot about specializing, and in fact, that's what I call them in our department at CCS. You can specialize in exterior, interior vehicles, which is vocational or recreational, and then mobility, which is fleets for shared use. So that's the way I break it down. But I'm thinking now that the term specialization isn't something that I really want to promote, because I think in the gig economy, students or designers will need to be able to apply their skill set to any given problem. Or starting a carrozzeria, you have at least an introductory knowledge of all these other disciplines as well, and you have a solid foundation in the design process.
Do you think that the established car companies, I mean, like, you know, we see companies such as Canoo, Lucid, Tesla to a certain degree, they have to do things a little bit differently. The teams are much smaller, of course, as well, because like the financial restrictions are just there. They don't have billions and billions to spend as companies. They don't have been in existence for such a long time, but obviously have fewer pressures as well. Do you think that the big companies are ready for this new kind of designer? Like, you know, the idea of someone like Sasha Silipanov being able to do their own 3D model, maybe not necessarily need a 3D model along their side, thinking completely in with Alias, maybe don't even need a clay model anymore. That's, of course, a whole different story. But, you know, do you think that these big companies are ready for this flexibility and understanding this flexibility also in their working pipeline to really use these kind of kids that come out in the best possible way, also giving them what you've mentioned in the beginning, the opportunity to do both interior, exterior, or maybe interior and UI or UX, like not to the fully detailed level, but, you know, understand the entire experience. Are they ready, or are they just behind at the moment because of their structure and process?
Well, I think it's very case by case. You know, I think the industry, just because of its size and the amount of capital investment involved, moves really slowly in terms of like cultural changes. So, you know, some companies are going to say they want the Renaissance designer who can do everything and anything, and they'll hire him, but that designer may not be stimulated enough. So it's up to the whether it be HR or the design management to keep this person engaged in a meaningful way. And if they're happy just doing one thing, you know, that's fine. But I know that students who truly think about, like, I feel like I'm in danger of just paying lip service to like the design process and human-centered design, just because it's become so common, these terms thrown around now. But I think that young people are wanting more meaning in what they do beyond a paycheck. So I think if these larger companies, more conservative larger companies, truly want that Renaissance designer, it's going to be their challenge to keep them engaged, inspired in a meaningful way, so that they feel like they're doing something with purpose in their life. And certainly these Renaissance designers are, you know, they get the multiple offers. You know, those are the ones that, you know, they'll get 3, 4, 5 offers, and they'll pick and choose who they want to go to. And they're also the young people, that is, they're also very interested to discover what the new companies are all about. And they have the energy to work, you know, the extra hours as well in the startup culture. I know that students that go to Tesla, Honda Advanced Studio, Zooks, those guys are really engaged, guys and girls. They're really engaged in their work because they're switching their roles almost, you know, daily, if not in the same day, having to change gears from UI to exterior, or from an interior component to something so broad, like what wide open question, like what will the, you know, future user experience be enabled by autonomous driving? You know, where are the opportunities there? I mean, talk about a white paper, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you deal with that? I mean, if I can imagine this is sometimes a tricky conversation to have, because you know, in the end, of course, your course is supposed to also give these kids a job, but also give them the idea of just like, hey, you can do something and you have the capabilities of doing something that maybe someone hasn't done before. From that perspective, how do you think that's gonna change for you? I mean, like, you know, the days of you're only, you know, producing designers for the OEMs is over. There's so many opportunities out there nowadays where they can be creatively stimulated from that perspective. How do you keep them, you know, in line so that they're not going too crazy and still learn the most important basics to find a career afterwards with all these distractions coming in from the outside world now on all different kind of levels?
Well, I try to coach the students and make them aware of where their strengths are. You know, a student that is spread really thin but not mastering anything, that student may be in danger of not getting a job, at least not right away. And a student that is really good at one thing, I might suggest that they do diversify their portfolio a little bit more. And then the students who are good at everything, I just give them career guidance on what companies might be more hospitable to their skill sets and personalities. And so it's a huge responsibility on my part. And, you know, but we have a great job placement record. We don't generally have hard data. Just because students disappear after they graduate, some keep in touch, and some, you know, just never hear from them again. They don't tell us when they get a job, but we have a pretty strong track record there, and so I think that while it's one of my biggest responsibilities that I have to my students, I'm pretty confident that we're doing well.
Yeah. Do you think
it's really portfolio coaching?
Do you think, well, let me rephrase that. How do you think, if I would ask you in, let's say, 10 years, your role as a design educator will have changed?
You know, the technology component is definitely going to be a part of it. My biggest sort of internal dialectic right now is the need for the traditional skill sets versus all the shortcuts that technology can provide. Mm-hmm. When you can go into a virtual gravity sketch environment or even just a polygonal modeling tool and do something, you know, reasonably well proportioned, and then assign the shaders and punch out a bunch of digital renderings of this polygonal model without drawing. If you can do all that without drawing, then why are we teaching drawing? Mm-hmm. So this is my biggest kind of personal internal debate. And I keep asking myself why I'm doing it, because I think that is really critically important to the quality of student that we turn out at CCS. If all these kids in this last year that did these outstanding projects for FCA, for Cadillac, and now the Mach-E, if those students didn't know how to draw in the first place, I'm certain, there's no way of proving this, of course, but I'm certain the results would have been very, very different and not as good. But it's the study of the traditional methods of drawing and sculpting, drawing from life, drawing from your imagination, that refines a student's sense of aesthetics and purpose and meaning. And without that, I think it becomes kind of an empty shell. that anybody can do, and that's fine. Maybe anybody will. But, you know, when you go to the store to buy a suit, are you going to, you know, buy one that, or just, you know, make it yourself if you feel like there's software available to design a suit? Or are you going to go to Tom Ford if you can afford it? You know, some people are just going to be better at doing things than you can do. So just because the process is somewhat more democratized with all these things like 3D printing and polygonal modeling doesn't mean that it will undermine the question of choices and tastes for people who are more discerning in their purchases and where they put their money. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, and I want to follow up this, you know, with a little bit of a, you know, of a question, of course, that goes into this entirety of this. So how important do you then think it would be to continue teaching clay modeling as well? Because what you've of course just mentioned is that to build up this kind of emotion, you could say I can model it in 3D and I can even 3D print it, but the question is how much can I then change it on the 3D printed model? You know, having it actually in my hands, feeling what I'm changing, what I'm doing, isn't it then the case that you would have to say, like, you know, the 3D modeling on a computer is an addition, but obviously the clay modeling and the understanding of what it really looks like physically and how it feels like will always be an important factor for a student or in general, kind of any designer that works in this vehicle, industry to always understand, because that's how you get the emotion.
Right. Right. Well, you know, we get pretty quickly into science fiction. I just started thinking of that scene in Minority Report where, Tom Cruise goes into the arcade and all these people are in these booths having these virtual experiences and things like that. The reason I thought of that is because, you know, until everything is virtual, we're still living in a physical world. And, you know, as long as the physicality of our surroundings and our bodies is there, then at least at the freshman and sophomore level, understanding of sculptural form through the act of touching and feeling and making it is going to be critical to the sensibilities that are brought to the technologies once those are introduced. So, you know, if we take our brains out and put them in a box and everything is completely, you know, virtual, then maybe we won't need clay modeling anymore. The Star Trek episode in there, I think.
No, I just find it important because, you know, there's this very massive debate going on, of course, of how much physical modeling do we need? Can we not just do more and more in, you know, in 3D, the VR kind of presentations and all these things? But in the end, like the decisions, or I would say the vast majority of these decisions are being made because you see a physical model in front of you, you know, mm-hmm. And as long as this emotional factor is in it, so that it really, you know, there is an importance on the aesthetics and on the design as a whole and the form and the function, of course, as well, you will need to have this understanding of the physical model as well. There will always be exception to that kind of case. I think, you know, there's some guys out there that can really think in 3D as well, which is a very rare case. But as long as you don't have that, and you always have to understand like who you're presenting to or who you're selling your design to, a lot of these guys cannot think in 3D. They need to see something in front of them. And so if we take this away from the designer and then present it to somebody who doesn't understand anything on this kind of, you know, virtual face, well, then we have a problem, because then you know, we add a communication issue, I think, mm-hmm. on top of that as well.
That's right. Well, and the other fact is, you know, a car is a new product, let's say, from a clean sheet of paper. What is it, about $5 billion of investment, maybe more now? if it's a, you know, an entirely new car, nobody's going to make those kinds of risky decisions without a thorough prototyping process. And so, like I said, it's going to be physical in the end, and at some point you got to go physical. I think, you know, while designers in the studio may not do as many clay models, I think at some point they're going to go into clay. And it may just be that cycle of creating a mesh, milling it, adjusting it, scanning it, going back to the data, refining the data, remilling it. It might be that, or it might be something more artistic and traditional along the lines of, you know, actually sculpting a handcrafted clay surface. But, you know, I don't think the clay modeling aspect is going to go away anytime soon. And it's really, again, it's case by case. Like some companies, they do not want us to get rid of clay modeling. That, you know, on the other hand, what is the point of milling a hard model when the student is you know, faced with hours and hours of sanding? You know, but you know what those hours and hours of sanding do is they drive a student's attention to detail and the extent to which they care about their craft. And whether it's the prototype or the initial theme model, or whether it's the final product on the road that somebody's going to lay down money to use or buy, the expression, or let's say that product, is that artifact is a record of the designer's state of mind, their ability to collaborate, their ability to answer the problems that they're being faced with, and their ability to care about that end user, the extent to which they really do care. You can tell when a product is the result of a bunch of people that didn't work well together, or a product of people who really did work well together.
Well said. And thank you very much for your time. But before I let you go, Paul, you're going to get three questions.
Oh, dear.
don't worry. Two of them don't necessarily have to have anything to do with transportation or automotive design. One of them is extremely automotive heavy. And we start with the first, you know, with the first two. Like, you don't have to go into too much car design. But if you could choose any project that you have not worked on in your career, which one would you choose?
That I have not worked on in my career. Well, something that I worked on a little bit, but really I wasn't a part of the team. I contributed to a brainstorming session one day, but I really wanted to be a part of the team, was the 24/7 concept that Lawrence von der Acker did when he was leading the Advanced Studios in California and Detroit. Mm-hmm. You remember the 24/7, those three cars?
Yeah.
Three little vehicles. They could have looked a lot better, but they were just so visionary. And that would be one.
Cool.
Yeah.
Second one. Which designer that you have or have not worked with was the biggest influence on your career?
Well, it's funny because I think it's the same. Although Lawrence and I never really worked that well together, that guy blew my mind. He really opened my mind up to a lot of different ways of looking at. He did this one thing that he called it the one. Just like there's an innocence about his optimism that is contagious. Mm-hmm. He did this car. It was called the One, and it was a pickup truck kind of a thing. It was very, very three box. So the front fender was the same as the rear fender because of the way on the opposite side of the car, because of the way it was like purely symmetrical from all views, right? And so Lawrence was really inspiring for me.
Last but certainly not least, if I give you a blank check, which car would you buy?
Oh my God. I'm always about like the vehicle for the purpose, right? I've always just been a huge fan. I would probably go with the a GT2 or something, Porsche GT2.
Which any specific model?
Yeah, definitely it'd be the 911 or the Carrera. What are you going to call it? It just, the thing is so timeless. It just keeps getting better. Can't say that about too many cars. They just keep getting better. There are a lot of other cars out there that are awesome. You know, I think the new Defender is really cool. And of course, you know, it's so nice to see the Ferraris looking good again. I lived through the 80s and some of those Ferraris and Alphas were just real stinkers, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, like we had a conversation, I think it was a few months ago on the pod as well. We talked a little bit about the Ferraris and, you know, you don't have to like all of them, but the average quality that they're now bringing out of their products is really good.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, just to have that kind of base level of where you say like, wow, like, you know, what's coming out here is just really good.
Yeah.
Is really impressive. I think this is one of the very few companies, and obviously they're, in terms of brand value, I think one of the highest rated car company nowadays.
Yeah.
And definitely. That shows how important the design is as well. Yeah. So that's certainly something of very much interest.
And they're pulling water from a stone too. I mean, they keep coming up with fresh ways of approaching these wonderful proportions. It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Before we drift off too much, because we could talk hours about Ferraris.
And, exactly. Yeah.
Probably beautiful Italian cars. Paul, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been the absolute pleasure. And obviously, we will link your LinkedIn profile into the subscription as well, into the show notes as well. We will link obviously CCS into the show notes as well. And of course, you know, once again, thanks for taking the time. I really do appreciate that. Your insights were fantastic.
Thank you, Martin. It was my pleasure.
And to all our listeners, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with the chairman of the College for Creative Studies in Detroit, Paul Snyder. And if you have any questions, any comments about this, feel free. Don't forget to rate and like us on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to us. And you will hear back from the Gestalten Podcast very soon with another episode. Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.